right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday, January 23rd, 2015. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Good morning, peoples. Happy Friday. I hope you're doing well. I know I have a fresh cup of coffee, and I just opened my eyes a few minutes ago. But, I did tons and tons of research last night. And came upon some interesting tidbits to continue on today with Precision Healthcare. Yeah, I got a little fired up yesterday over that. And it lasted most of the day, but I gave it up around dinner and then hopped back onto it last night after I got up. It's all about the money. That's what we said. It's all about the money. I want to share something, though, before we even get back into Precision Healthcare, because it's only 2 minutes after 10. And I know people in the class were complaining yesterday that they weren't going to be able to keep up with the homework. So we'll slow it down just a little bit. One of the things that has been concerning me over the last few days, a few of you may remember, I mentioned the other day my cat is sick. And that might not sound like a big deal, but none of us like to see when our pets are ill. And my one poor little kitty was puking, and then it was for one day. She was very sick. I don't know where that came from. I mean, they're not outdoor cats. The other cats upstairs all ate the same food. No one else got sick. So I deemed it a little suspicious. She ended up sleeping for the next couple days. You know, finally started eating and drinking a little bit, and then got this horrible, horrible, sneezy, coughy, runny, eye, nose blowing cold. And my other cat, Simon, this is girly, my other cat, Simon, a couple weeks before that, he had had that horrible nose blowing snot cold. He just, like, he insists he's got to sleep in my room. And when he comes in, there were a few times he's standing right over me and just, poof, I was like, gross cat. So here's the thing. I started thinking about this. I'm like, where the hell did this cat get sick from? I mean, we haven't been anywhere. Nobody has stray cats. My cats don't go outside. You know what I mean? And I had been sick. Remember, I had that horrible flu back. It started right around Christmas Eve, I believe, when it hit me. And I'm still, my nose is all stuffed up again today. I mean, this has been ongoing. It's been almost a month. And, you know, all my friends who ended up getting it still have it, too. It hasn't quite gone away. It does. Like, it goes away. And then as soon as you get tired, almost, it seems, it comes back. Like, your immune system isn't fully fighting it. But I started thinking, hey, maybe, just maybe, I know when I was a kid, I had remembered a few instances where I was pretty 100% certain that my cat had caught an illness for me. You know, back in the 80s, they always laughed at that. Animals can't catch anything from people. Animals are stupid, too. They don't have emotions. That's what they said. Well, we all know that that's wrong, especially anyone who's lived closely and had a pet for many years. They know that that is absolutely incorrect. So, where my research began last night was at apparently the Oregon State University. Oregon, sorry. I stand corrected. Not Oregon, it's Oregon. Speak to natives, that's what they'll tell you. Here we go. So, anyone for a cat or a dog, be aware of this. Can you really give your dog or your cat the flu? And remember to, well, here, let me just read this first. As flu season approaches, many people who get sick may not realize that they can pass the flu not only to other humans, but possibly to other animals, including pets such as cats, dogs, and ferrets. This concept called reverse zoonosis is still poorly understood, but has raised concern among some scientists and veterinarians who want to raise awareness and further prevent flu transmission to pets. About 80 to 100 households in the United States have a cat or dog. It is well known that new strains of influenza can evolve from animal populations such as pigs and birds and ultimately move into human populations, including the influenza pandemic strain, N1H1. It's less appreciated, said experts, that humans appear to have passed the H1N1 flu to cats and other animals, some of which have died of respiratory illness. There are only 100 of known cases of this phenomenon, and the public health implications of reverse zoonosis of flu remain to be determined. But as a concern for veterinarians, it has raised troubling questions and so far very few answers. Veterinary researchers at Oregon State University and Iowa, so Jax, if you're out there, Iowa State University, are working to find more cases of this type of disease transmission and better understand any risk they pose to people and animals. We worry a lot about zoonosis, the transmission of diseases from animal to people, said Christine Lohr, an associate professor at Oregon State University College of Veterinary Medicine. But most people do not realize that humans can also pass diseases to animals, and this raises questions and concerns about mutations, new viral forms, and evolving diseases that may potentially be zoonotic. And, of course, there is concern about the health of the animals. Of course there is. And a woman says that who's probably running a flu lab with animal participants. No, she's a veterinary school, not a drug testing school necessarily. Honestly, though, I don't know anything about the Oregon State University Veterinary School, so I will reserve my judgment. All right. The researchers are surveying flu transmission to household cats and dog populations and suggest that people with influenza-like illness distance themselves from their pets. If a pet experiences respiratory disease or other illness following household exposure to someone with flu-like illnesses, the scientists encourage them to take the pet to a veterinarian for testing and treatment. So I'm telling you, I am pretty certain now, because now it's passing to the third cat. I am pretty certain now this came from me. I think my first cat got it from me. And his lingered for a couple weeks, but he wasn't anywhere near as sick as the little one is now. She got really sick. I might have to actually take her to the vet today. But he would, you know, and he just sneezes on people. But, you know, he slept with me every single night, and he's such my little watcher. So he was always watching me when I was sick to make sure I was all right. He's the type of cat that'll, like, come over and stare right into your face 10 times a night and make sure you're breathing. He's really funny. Not that that's funny, but, I mean, that's the type of cat he is. And he was very close the whole time I was sick. So it wouldn't surprise me that he possibly caught it. And then it passed fast, though, between the cats. All right. I wanted to. It's a long article, and my eyes are, like, bouncing around on the bright white screen as they just woke up. It's, like, searing my retinas. All right, so they encourage you to take the pet to the veterinarian for testing and treatment. The first recorded probable case of fatal human-to-cat transmission from pandemic H1N1 flu virus occurred in Oregon in 2009. Details were published in the Veterinary Pathology, a professional journal, and in that instance, the pet owner became severely ill with the flu and had to be hospitalized. While she was in the hospital, her cat, an indoor cat with no exposure to other sick people, homes, or wildlife, also died of pneumonia that was caused by an H1N1 infection. That's why I'm a little bit worried. I mean, she's been eating a little and drinking a little, but you could tell, I mean, she's usually just so energetic and alive, and she's not feeling well at all. And it's been 4 days, and it's just a small little animal. Since then, researchers have identified a total of 13 cats and one dog with pandemic H1N1 infection in 2011 and 2012 that appeared to have come from humans. Pet ferrets have also been shown to be infected and some died. All the animal symptoms were similar to that of humans. They rapidly develop a severe respiratory disease. Some stop eating and some die. Serological studies suggest that there's far more exposure to flu virus in cats and dogs than previously known. I mean, honestly, when I was a kid, there were multiple instances where I was certain that my illness had passed to the animals, and they never believed any of that. I mean, all that was just mumbo jumbo voodoo science. But this is leading me to believe that it is very well known, and we just don't realize it. I'm sure there's a lot of things that way. All right. Pet ferrets have also shown to be infected. Some died, blah, 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 blah. Oh, yeah. It is reasonable to assume that there are many more cases than we know about, and we want to learn more, said Lore. Anytime you have an infection of a virus into a new species, it is a concern, a black box of uncertainty, and we don't know for sure what the implications might be, but we do think this deserves more attention. Natural and experimental transmission of the H3N2 influenza virus from cats to dogs in South Korea, where they don't have probably ethics laws. That's where they eat cats and dogs for dinner, I think, right? That's where you see all those horrible... I'm not even going to talk about... natural and experimental transmission of the H3N2 influenza virus from dogs and cats in South Korea showed the potential for flu viruses to be transmitted among various animal species, Laura said. It is unknown if an infected cat or dog could then pass the influenza back to humans. Well, they better be careful and say no, because that's the reason that they go out and call all of the chickens, is because humans can catch bird flu from birds, so they go kill a million of them at a time. So if they, and remember during Ebola, there was some question as to whether or not the dogs could harbor it, and they destroyed some of the dogs of the Ebola people, the Ebola patients, because they were afraid that if the dog was incubating Ebola or a carrier, that it would be able to pass on to other humans. So this isn't looking good. This could definitely, in an emergency, be a way for them to decide that our animals are going to disappear if they can show that flus and viruses, and especially dangerous pathogens, ones that would require quarantine. And remember, they mentioned flu in here. I mean, flu that then led to pneumonia, and that's what killed the cat. Remember, that was actually listed in that executive order from July. They included pneumonia as a quarantinable illness. The primary concern in reverse zoonosis, as in evolving flu viruses in more traditional hosts such as birds and swine, is that any new movement of a virus from one species to another, the virus might mutate into a more virulent, harmful, or easily transmissible form. And we've talked about that. And not just between animals and humans, but like that original, the fairy tale Ebola story, like who even knows at this point? But there was a whole agenda that Ebola scare triggered. And we'll look at the rest of that. That's kind of where I was digging last night. But remember, they had talked about how many times, I don't even remember the number, it's been months now, but how many times it was mutating from host to host. And that only came out in the very beginning. I don't know. There was a lot of weirdness with that. All viruses can mutate, but the influenza virus raises special concern because it can change whole segments of its viral sequence fairly easily, Lore said. In terms of hosts and mutations, who's to say that the cat couldn't be the new pig? Uh-oh. We'd just like to know more about this, unquote. Hide your pets. They're coming for them, too. Veterinarians who encounter possible cases of this phenomenon can obtain more information from Lore at the Iowa or Oregon State University. They are both, they are doing research, as another lady, Jesse, somebody. They are doing ongoing research to predict, prevent, or curtail emerging events. Okay, I'm going to drop this in the chat. I really don't like what this is implying. I mean, I'm worried about my kitty cat, but I am not liking how they are implying that our pets could be carriers and we can pass things back and forth. I don't like the fact that I very possibly could be responsible for my poor little kitty cat getting really sick. That's not a nice thought. She's just so sweet, too. So I feel pretty guilty. I mean, I obviously didn't do it on purpose. But what do you do? And it was such a horrible upper respiratory infection. And, you know, she was very sick before that. I mean, it really wears you down when you have nothing in your stomach because it's all gone and you're probably partially dehydrated and then you don't really feel good and you don't feel like eating and now you can't smell. I just thought, what an interesting way. If they really wanted to get to us, would be to engineer some type of flu. And they've talked about this. Remember, I mentioned many times in regards to zombie virus. Remember when all that was going on like 3 years ago? It was pretty big. Everyone was on the zombie virus thing. And three scientific-esque publications came out. The two that I remember off the top of my head, actually I do remember them all, it was Scientific American, Discover, National Geographic, all came out with stories about the zombie virus and how it could possibly happen. And the best one was the National Geographic, I thought, for like the most evilest plan and probably the easiest way to do it, and that was using the flu virus and mixing it with rabies and then spraying it aerosol-y. So it was very easily transmissible between people once you were infected with it. And the rabies virus itself worked on the portion of the brain that controlled motor controls and emotions and being able. So, I mean, think about it. Once rabies goes rampant in your brain, pretty much all animals with rabies have left. They're confused. They can't think anymore, really, with any type of logical thought. And they have bloodlust. So that would kind of, that definitely would take care of it definitely would take care of a lot of the stupid people. It would take care of a lot of people. Especially if it was some kind of nasty flu. All right. Let's take a look. So I started digging into Watson. I know yesterday, here, let's look at this. Yesterday, we had talked about precision medicine, the State of the Union, Obama deciding that we're all behind this. It's going to be this individualized healthcare. And the one paragraph that caught me and made me get, like, all upset to begin with was, quote, as a multidisciplinary approach to healthcare, it will involve physicians, geneticists, pharmaceutical developers, public policy wonks, venture capitalists, or venture investors, and regulators like the FDA, unquote. I mean, what an unholy group of people who have self-aggrandizing reasons for doing this. It's not about your healthcare. It's about making money. Like I said, getting rid of that R&D line item in the budget to save the public corporation's funding so they could show a profit. We had talked about Watson. We're going to look a little bit more at Watson, which is the IBM cognitive computing platform. And one of the branches that they've really branched it out into is healthcare. And back when we first started reading about Watson, I mean, he's been around for a long time. I remember even when I was a tech, they were working on Watson. But most of you will remember Watson on Jeopardy, right? He actually beat two humans with his question and answering capabilities and being able to sift through information. So they've now taken that technology and they've applied it to certain verticals, one of which is healthcare. And one of the things I had postulated is that with Obamacare, they had talked about how there aren't going to be enough doctors to take care of all these supposed people now that are going to have healthcare. And one of the things that I had done a lot of work on when I was still working was e-medicine. And that was with remote, remote doctor. I don't even know what you'd call it. And we've seen it where they have the little remote robot things or they have the remote HD camera and, they can connect up one doctor to 54 little villages, right, if they had internet access. And you could have access then to at least some professional medical advice. You have some sort of nursing staff or physician's assistant at the location. And then the doctor themselves is at a central location and providing, diagnostics and whatever. So that was a big thing, but this goes even way above and beyond. So now Watson has moved into all kinds of different things. He's working in, they got the application working in the Mayo Clinic. They've been doing testing at the Cleveland Clinic, at Sloan Kettering Medical Center, I was reading. But one of the, and we'll get into that, but one of the things I wanted to mention is about the whole Nazi thing. I had mentioned that yesterday, and I hadn't dug into it to actually find out who Watson was, and duh, he was the CEO of IBM that actually founded the company. I found a story that originally was posted in the Village Voice in New York back in 2002. I guess NYU had a lot of the original Nazi documents, and I'm sure that's because they have the Tisch School and whatever. It probably is for part of the Holocaust Museum. But let me just read a little bit of this. So how interesting is it that Thomas J. Watson, who was the founding CEO of IBM, worked directly with Hitler with his, what they call the automated Nazi death machine, and it was software and punch cards for tracking all the incoming and outgoing train traffic as they were shipping people in to Germany. And a lot of the people that worked on the project were forced labor. I was reading a lot of them were Polish Jews. This actually took place in Poland, a lot of this. And they didn't know what they were doing. I mean, maybe they knew what they were doing, but they didn't know what the train schedules were about. But it was Watson. And they, IBM maintained ownership over all that machinery during the whole time. And they had someone there 24/7 to do maintenance on the equipment and whatever. They were very in bed. I didn't realize the extent of it. They were very in bed with Hitler. So when I take a look at now IBM's new cognitive computing platform that they're going to roll out into all of our verticals, healthcare, banking. I mean, I dug deep into their marketing plan last night to see how the hell they were spinning this all up and putting a big ugly bow on it. And I was quite horrified that they name this cognitive computer Watson. And then the first thing they really put him on is healthcare. And not only do they put him on healthcare, but when I was digging, I found that there was a pre-project to this called Lucy that IBM was a big part of. And Lucy, guess what country Lucy's in? Africa! To help those Africans with their healthcare right before Ebola breaks out. Now, who would have thunk it? Guys, I'm telling you, when I really started looking at this, this is a eugenics step in the forward direction if I ever saw one. And IBM's Watson has been reincarnated from the grave now in a digital format. Not literally. I mean, they probably could. Kurzweil would probably be all for it. But how messed up is that? That they name this healthcare system Watson. And I mean, my one friend's like, well, Watson's a common name. They could have called it Watson for everything. Yeah, but it was your founding CEO that worked with the Nazis, Watson. That is a little too coincidental for me. All right, so let me read this quick. This is a reprint out of the Village Voice from March 27th through April 2nd, 2002 edition. I've read the Village Voice many times when I was in the Village. And by the way, do you know what's in the Village now on Astor Street? I thought I saw yesterday is IBM's headquarters for Watson's Cognitive Computing. They are in the Village of New York City. What a weird place for them to put their business headquarters. But yeah, I was very surprised. It's in the East Village. How IBM helped to automate the Nazi death machine in Poland. When Adolf Hitler came to power in 1933, most of the world saw a menace to humanity, but IBM saw Nazi Germany as a lucrative trading partner. Now remember, too, there's such a huge story here. Good old granddaddy Bush, Bush Sr.'s father was very involved. He was part of Harriman Brothers that helped finance all of this as well. So there's a big, long, ugly connection between governments, corporations, and eugenics. All I know is that this cannot be good for us. All right. Let me go back here. But IBM saw Nazi Germany as a lucrative trading partner. Its president, Thomas J. Watson, engineered a strategic business alliance between IBM and the Reich, beginning in the first days of the Hitler's regime and continuing right through World War II. This alliance catapulted Nazi Germany to become IBM's most important customer outside of the U.S. IBM and the Nazis jointly designed and IBM exclusively produced technological solutions that enabled Hitler to accelerate and in many ways automate key aspects of persecutions of Jews, homosexuals, Jehovah's Witnesses, and other Nazis considered enemies. I'm going to tell you what's, when I was reading this, all I kept thinking was, this new Watson project is all about utilizing the genome to identify traits in you. Well, you know, back in Nazi Germany, by your last name and your look, they identified you as a Jew, a homosexual, a Jehovah's Witness, and any other Nazi enemy that wasn't up to snuff with blonde hair and blue eyes. Now all they got to do is look at your genetic code. Like I ended the show yesterday, there was that new story about five genetic traits now that they've discovered that make you a brainiac. Well, they're going to do a swab and say, hey, look, you don't have the smart gene. So as part of your targeted personal therapy, your precision medicine, we are going to recommend that you have permanent infertility. We wouldn't want to breed stupid people now, would we? You know, I mean, that's to the level that they could take this. And, you know, my friend that never agrees with anything was, God, I was argue last night. I was ready to puke. There was so much arguing. It says point, counterpoint. There's nothing I can say that isn't counterpointed because I'm wrong. But I'm not wrong. Yes, technology can be used for good. Yes, I can look at these companies like IBM, and they created the first personal computer. They did lots of good things. But that doesn't mean that what we see culminating here for the future of humanity, all the potentials, that does not mean that it's going to be the best thing in humanity's best interest in the end. It's all about the people who are pulling the strings. And I mean, say what you will. Maybe I'm crazy. Maybe all the oligarchs in charge right now are just kind-hearted, ethical, moral people and don't want to get rid of the lower, oh, I don't know, 95%. Maybe I'm totally wrong on that. But who's to say the next ones or the ones after that in line that are running the show aren't going to decide that that might be a good idea. Exterminate most of them. Dirty hippies, right? I mean, what is it this generation? All right. Custom designed, IBM produced punch cards sorted by IBM machines leased to the Nazis helped organize and manage the initial identification and social expulsion of different ethnic groups and the confiscation of their property, their ghettoization, their deportation, and ultimately their extermination. Recently discovered Nazi documents and Polish eyewitness testimony make clear that IBM's alliance with the Third Reich went far beyond its German subsidiary. A key factor in the Holocaust in Poland was IBM's technology provided directly through a special wartime Polish subsidiary reporting to IBM New York, mainly to its headquarters at 590 Madison Avenue. So I didn't realize. So that's why they moved it to the village, because their actual corporate headquarters is on Madison Ave. And that's how the trains to Auschwitz all ran on time. Thousands of IBM's documents reviewed for the first edition of my book. And this is whoever the guy's writing this, but he's an IBMer. IBM and the Holocaust, published earlier last year and focused mainly on IBM's German subsidiary, revealed vigorous efforts to preserve IBM's monopoly in the Nazi market and increase contracts to meet wartime sales quotas. Since then, continued research and interviews have uncovered details described here for the first time of IBM's work for the Nazis in Poland through a separate subsidiary and of the Polish subsidiary's direct contact with IBM's officials on Madison Ave. Documents were obtained from IBM files shipped to NYU for processing and from scores of other archival sources here and abroad. Not a single sentence written by IBM personnel has been discovered in any of the documents questioning the morality of automating the Third Reich, even when headlines proclaim the mass murder of millions. You know, guys, this is what happens when large corporations work with government leaders. Do you hear what I'm reading? Is there automating all this stuff? And do you remember what I was reading yesterday about precision medicine? And oh, by the way, when I start reading a few more stories here about the precision medicine announcement, guess who? Like I said yesterday, guess who's right in the middle of it? But IBM's Watson. I don't know if I'm going to have time really to read a lot more of this. We could probably do a whole day or two on all of IBM's connections and famous-ish people that we know of in Nazi Germany. But I'm just trying to scroll down to see that one part I was reading yesterday. I mean, IBM owned all the machines. They developed the machines in total cahoots with the Nazis, and they had people there to monitor and maintain them 24/7. And it even talks about specifically, there's a picture when I posted this in the Dystopia News. I found a picture yesterday of IBM's Watson, the CEO founder, sitting, having a meeting with Hitler. But they had very, oh my God, it's still early and the time's ticking. They had very frequent, sorry, my words don't work too well first thing. They had very frequent meetings. So Watson was fully complicit in all of this. All right, you know what? I'm going to drop this in the chat. If you guys want to read this whole story, you can. It was, let me give you the link, emperors-clothes.com/analysis/IBM.htm. Like I said, that was a reprint from an original Village Voice article. That story, I mean, this guy did tons and tons of research, and this guy wrote a whole book about it. Edwin Black, author of IBM and the Holocaust, the strategic alliance between Nazi Germany and America's most powerful corporation is the title of the book. It definitely sounds like something that would be worth reading. But why was IBM never prosecuted? You know, that's a good question. Why is IBM still allowed to be this massive behemoth? And I mean, when I was doing tech support, and I was a systems engineer for distribution, I was a subject matter expert for HP mainly. Compaq was my sideline, and IBM was the third kick. That's what we did. We got all the training, we had all the manuals, we had all the certifications. And the one thing I can tell you is IBM is massive, but they are dumb on a business side of things. They really are dumb when they release product and then discontinue hard drives in 2 weeks for a server that they're trying to sell. You know, they're really dumb when every single quarterly configuration guide came out with wrong part numbers all over it because no one ever double checked them. They're big and bloated like a huge corporation should be and have more money than they know what to do with. So how are they still in business? You know, you see a lot of these other businesses going under. I mean, God, wait until next month. My dad and I were just talking yesterday, and I have seen so many news stories about mass layoffs here, mass layoffs there, mass. Wait until next month as Barry's up there talking about the great economy and how awesome everything is doing. Yeah. The State of the Union is a perfectly timed address. Still reeling from the drunken spending of Christmas and the holidays. And you haven't quite had the culling of the post-holiday credit card depression blues. Speaking of culling, in one of these stories I was reading yesterday, that is the exact term that they use to refer to pharmaceutical companies accessing your data. They cull the data. I just had to kind of go, oh, what a nice choice of words. All right. This I made the mistake of like biting off way more than I could chew here. There's a lot. We'll have to continue this on Monday, I guess. All right. Let's take a look here at Watson. This is research.ibm.com. Watson Paths, PATHS, is the name of the program that is specifically for doctors. After a year-long research collaboration with faculty, and this there are a bunch of stories. So there's all kinds of universities and medical centers they're working with now. After a year-long research collaboration with faculty, physicians, and students at the Cleveland Clinic, Lerner College of Medicine, and Case Western University, IBM Research has unveiled two cognitive computing technologies that can be used by Watson. And they're getting all these universities and hospitals, actually, to help them build the software by being their guinea pigs. And are expected to help make physicians more informed and give them accurate decisions faster. Oh, yeah, and here we go. And to call new insights from your electronic medical records. The project known as Watson Paths and Watson EMR, Electronic Medical Record Assistant, will create technologies that can be used by Watson in the domain of medicine. With the Watson Paths project, IBM scientists have trained the system to interact with medical domain experts in a way that is more natural for them, enabling the user to more easily understand the structured and unstructured data sources the system consulted and the path it took to offering an option. Watson's Electronic Medical Record Assistant project aims to enable physicians to uncover key information from patients' medical records in order to help improve the quality and efficiency of healthcare. Through our research collaboration with Cleveland Clinic, we've been able to significantly advance technologies that Watson can leverage now to handle more and more complex problems in real time and partner with medical experts in a much more intuitive fashion. These are breakthrough technologies intending to assist future versions of Watson products. Now, Here, actually, let me read this little section too. Watson's electronic medical records assistant unlocking the promises of electronic medical records. Remember, I told you that, you know, the way they're going to sell it to you is that the reason why we all need to be on electronic medical records now, and we talked about how a lot of the doctors are just small businesses. So many of the individuals who had their own offices, I mean, they've been pushing this for almost 10 or 12 years now. But I saw that they've drawn like a final deadline. A lot of the hospitals got on board. So any hospital that the doctor was affiliated with kind of took on a lot of that responsibility now. So the doctors just have to have a piece of software on their end. And anything that's inputted is then stored at the central level for your records. But they're going to sell it to you as the technology that's going to save your life. Like I said yesterday, if you're 1,000 miles away from home and they don't know you're allergic to penicillin. But there's much more insidious implications here by putting every detail about you into a database, including this whole precision medicine bullshit about connecting it to your genetic code and coming up with genetic cures. And wait until you hear this. This is such a bunch of utter bullshit. When I actually got into the dollars and cents and the economics of it all, it's like I've said forever. This technology stuff that they're working on, this live forever longevity projects, which I'm sure if we take a look, all of this is somewhere a part of some rich billionaire who's financing how to live forever. All of this is for the rich. When a treatment is going to cost you, yeah, they'll be able to fix your cystic fibrosis. They've done it. But do you know what? That guy's medication is $300,000 a year. Oh, he can't afford that. So how are they making him the first test guinea pig? Well, it's government financed. I mean, guys, this is beyond criminal. Beyond criminal. And they're going to be using our federal research dollars to come up with all this shit. To enslave us, to database us, to bag us and tag us, to use you and your children as guinea pigs, to help Watson discover all the truth, what kills you and what doesn't, to be able to then make some rich billionaire live forever eventually. That's what it's all about. IBM and Cleveland Clinic are also using Watson to explore how to navigate and process electronic medical records to unlock hidden insights within the data. This is what I was saying yesterday. With the goal of helping physicians make more informed and accurate decisions about patient care, this massive amount of health data within electronic medical records alone presents tremendous value in transforming clinical decision making, but can also be difficult to absorb. For example, analyzing a single patient's electronic medical record can be equivalent to going through 100 megs of structured and unstructured data in the form of plain text that can span a lifetime of clinical notes, lab results, and medication history. Watson's natural language processing capabilities allows it to process an electronic medical record with a deep semantic understanding of the content and can help medical practitioners quickly and efficiently sift through massive amounts of complex and disparate data and make better sense of it all. You better believe that if they haven't, they will set Watson loose on the internet. I mean, I know that Google's been working on that. I'm sure that they've had Watson's cognitive computing scraping through. I mean, I had read about that a long time ago, that there was some project going on where they'll be able to take anything and everything we ever wrote on the internet, regardless of what format it is, structured or unstructured, scrape it, and then start figuring out like colloquialisms and figuring out the context, the meaning of words via the context of how it's used. That's exactly what this is talking about doing. Working with de-identified electronic medical record data provides the Cleveland Clinic, and with direction from Cleveland Clinic physicians, the goal of the Watson EMR Assistant Research Project is to develop technologies that will be to collate key details of past medical histories and present the physician with a problem list of clinical concerns that may require treatment, blah, 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 blah. Whatever. That's a load of just sales information to get you to want to be on the Watson system. I think the name should cause us to run away. I want to see quick. Let me just see. There's a video here, and I don't know. Jay, I don't know if there is audio or not, but we will find out. Ansa? Wow. That's a lot of background noise. All right, here we go. Let's see if Watson's video airs anything or if it's just visual. It's nothing. Oh, it's blocking. It's trying.
This is Watson Pats, a research project we are working on with Cleveland Clinic to develop a new cognitive computing tool for learning and teaching. It will be designed to help physicians and medical students learn how to make more informed and accurate decisions faster. The tool will enable quick navigation of the latest medical information and will show how physicians and medical students can learn critical reasoning skills from the initial clinical observations all the way to possible diagnoses and treatment options. First, I'll begin by selecting a hypothetical case that a student might be presented with. What you see here are a number of hypothetical medical cases that are similar to those used in the U.S. medical licensing exam.
That's 3 minutes of just drivel. I don't want to listen to that. Here, I'll drop this for you. You guys really want to check into this Watson Paths. It's, I don't know. I don't think that this is a good thing. I mean, maybe it'll make my doctor smarter. But it's also going to bag and tag everything about me that's none of their freaking business. And remember, we talked about yesterday this whole push toward getting rid of HIPAA. I was reading about that yesterday, too, and they absolutely are. They're working on it. They don't think that we should have privacy. They think our metadata should be shared to help the world. I mean, I don't mind helping the world, maybe, but they don't need to have ownership of my data. I'm going to read a little section here. IBM Watson takes on global challenges in healthcare, business, and finance. Yeah, what nice two verticals. Three. I mean, business and finance are somewhat related. Healthcare, of course, with big pharma. It's hard to believe that in only 10 short months since IBM's Watson group was announced, it's come this far. We've talked of bringing together a unique group of people. This includes the largest movement of IBM's research personnel in our history, along with 10 to 12 startups worth of new cognitive technologies that would help define the Watson team. 10 to 12 new startup companies using cognitive computing. A new approach to engaging the market would be to create, would be created from talent across IBM sales, marketing, services, and consulting organizations. A new cloud, delivery organization would be formed out of our services team to serve this market and all brought together for a single purpose to usher in a new era of computing. So not only are they doing this cognitive computing and all this other garbage, but they're doing it in the cloud too. 10 months later, we marvel at the progress that has been made beyond the beginnings of Project Lucy in Africa. Clients in South Africa have now joined our cause. And that's where I wanted to pause this because, again, how interesting that IBM has a big presence in Africa. And that's where this started. And it was 10 months ago. We're talking, and that article was from like mid-2014. So 2013, about the time that we had Ebola companies making drugs and going public. IBM, here we go. So this talks about this Project Lucy, confronting Africa's grand challenges with Watson's help. This guy, amid the chaos of civil war, I can't even say this guy's name, his family fled to Somalia in a rush. When he was just 5 years old, he and his sister escaped to London in the care of his aunt. His father flew to Sweden and his mother made her way through the battle zone to Kenya. His childhood experience was common for Somalis of his generation, and many people had it much worse. But he stands out in another way. After living in the UK and the US for 25 years, he is returning to Africa next month to help solve many of its problems. This is from February of 2014, the story. Is a new member of a team at IBM Research Africa. It could have easily been me still in Somalia living on $2 a day with no access to clean water. He says, it is my social responsibility to go back and give back. He arrives at the lab just in time to participate in a new major initiative aimed at doing just that. Project Lucy is a 10-year, $100 million effort by IBM to work with governments, universities, and development organizations to address Africa's grand challenges. I mean, here's the thing. Do not think that IBM is not in that key select group, because they are, and they're very important, it seems. A key element will be harnessing IBM's Watson. IBM announced the initiative today while Chief Executive Ginni Rometty and members of her senior executive team were meeting with government and business leaders in, Nigeria. IBM established its first African research facility in Nairobi, Kenya last year, and plans on expanding to other countries. Even now, the Watson capability, which is delivered as a cloud service, will be available for projects wherever IBM does business on the continent. And remember, those cloud services can be sold as what? Monthly subscription software as a service. Remember, we talked about that yesterday. IBM Research Director John Kelly promised to bring Watson to Africa in a meeting with business and academic leaders 1 year ago. He urged them to propose ambitious projects that would require using the most advanced cognitive computing technology in the world. The lab took input from local leaders and, as a result, expanded its mission to target Africa's grand challenges. You know, when I was thinking about this, I was like, oh, how interesting they called it Lucy, because wasn't there that skeleton that they found that was supposed to be like the oldest ever skeleton that they pointed to on the cover of Discover magazine like 20 years ago and said, look, all civilization began here. Well, I was right. The team chose, quote-unquote, Lucy as the name for the project because of the significance of the discovery of her fossilized remains in the Ethiopia's Rift Valley in 1974. Just as Lucy was the precursor to humans, scientists see Watson as an early example of cognitive computing. The lab's leaders hope that big data analytics and cognitive computing will provide breakthroughs of similar magnitude. Yeah, this is massive, guys. You know, if you remember a video we listened to months ago that SLC Mike had dropped on cognitive, the future of cognitive computing, where then you're just going to have very small little embedded devices or shit, maybe even swallowable devices, implants that allow you to be able to see the screen with your eyes, and it'll already be like staying ahead of your thoughts to be able to augment, that's what it was, augmented computing. Again, I'm running out of time very, very quickly. I can't even believe like 2 hours seems like it's an eon and an hour seems like it's 10 minutes. I just dropped that in a chat too. You could search the IBM Watson Africa project if you want that. But here's what I want to catch at the end. Here is the end. Actually, there are two little blurbs. So I want to read this in The Motley Fool, which is some sort of, you know, investment online publication. They give a couple paragraphs talking about precision medicine. Here I'm going to quote, it's a maturing field. To design drugs for genetic mutations, you must find genetic mutations first. The falling cost to sequence human genomes has made it much easier to do precision medicine and allowed companies to profit from it. While there are many drugs on the market and many more in the clinic that I would put into the class of precision medicine, this field is far from mature. There are also numerous diseases in which underlying causes still aren't known. So the medications can only treat the symptoms. The downside to treating a subset of patients that is that precision needs to be higher priced medication. The cost of developing drugs is about the same as with all pharmaceuticals. So companies have to charge way more to make up for their lower volume. And that is the key right there. So I found a story in Forbes that actually kind of outlines the nuts and bolts of this. And you're going to see just how amazingly interesting this is. This is all going to be paid for on the taxpayer dime. That's what I can't even believe. I mean, remember they had that new pharmaceutical bill that Obama inked that ended up making things way more expensive for everyone? Well, this is just, I can't even believe. What, are we going to make socialized longevity care now? Is that what's going to happen? And only if you deserve it? Only if you have the right genes? Obama's precision medicine initiative, paying for precision drugs is the challenge. Precision medicine has evolved from a concept of personalized medicine in that our focus in disease treatment and prevention is not semantically correct, focused solely on the individual. Instead, medicines are emerging that are targeted precisely to a subset of molecular problems shared by small groups within the larger population with a given disease. Precision medicines are those directed toward a precise defect in primary cause of a disease to either inhibit a malfunction or better restore a normal function. The goal of precision medicine is to give the treatment to patients most likely to benefit because we now know the precise cause at the genetic level for diseases in this group. The precision comes from advances in genetics and protein biochemistry that allows diseases to be identified and then broken down into subsets based on precise defects that cause the disease. While this is possible because we are only making medication for small numbers of people, it's going to potentially cost millions of dollars to develop drugs for a small subset of maybe 3,000 people in the population with a disease. And guys, I got 15 seconds left. So damn it. Happy Friday anyway. Make sure you guys stick around. I hope everybody has a good weekend. I'll be in and out. Stick around tonight. We got Josh live, Anti-Media. We got Truth on the Tracks, United Front Radio, and sorry, Josh is Anti-Tyranny and Anti-Media at 11. All right, guys, everybody have a great weekend. We'll catch up on Monday. Take care.